Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning, March 21. So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. And you can hear us anywhere live online by going to 883wppb.org. And each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com. And each show is turned into a podcast, so you can listen to it at your leisure. Well, in these most challenging times, I urge all of you to self-quarantine and to realize that any age, anybody can be a carrier of COVID-19. I also urge you not to buy up everything in sight at the grocery store. These reports are troubling. We must think of our neighbors, of people less fortunate. Don't be selfish. We as a country, as a community, we need to stay positive. We need to adhere to all the recommendations from government officials and the Center of Disease Control and Prevention guidelines. And you know what they are. Wash your hands, avoid close contact with anybody, stay at least 6 feet apart from anyone, clean and disinfect frequently touched surfaces. And I can't thank and commend all the individuals in the medical profession enough who are working overtime to care for people who have contracted the virus, and just all the people who are on the front lines trying to protect us. We as a nation, we can pull together. We can get through this most trying time. Our country is made up of really good people, caring people, incredibly smart people. We need to all do our part to get through this together. This morning, I thought you'd enjoy traveling back in time a bit, certainly to a more simpler, gentler time. From 1989 to about 2006, I hosted, produced, and distributed a weekly cable series called Sports Interview, which aired for many years on MSG Network and then on what was Fox Sports New York. Well, Sports Interview, the cable show, also aired all over the country on regional sports cable networks. And yeah, I think we were ahead of our time. As a woman in the sports broadcasting biz who started in the mid-80s, it was a trailblazing time, I can assure you. I had more doors slammed in my face than those that weren't. But somehow, I managed to acquire the funding for Sports Interview, the cable series, to air every week for 17 straight years. It was an adventure. There were a lot of ups. There were a lot of downs. But you regular listeners have heard some of these classic sports interview shows that I've replayed on this show, and I hope you have enjoyed them. They are 22 minutes of exclusive interviews with some of the top legends in sports, many of whom aren't around anymore. So, you know, I find them enlightening, entertaining, educational, and I hope you do too. This morning, you'll hear the classic interviews I did with two of the most legendary athletes in their sport, Gordie Howe in hockey and Will Chamberlain in basketball. Now, Gordie Howe played 26 seasons in the National Hockey League from 1946 to 1980. Mr. Hockey, as he was nicknamed, showed off his all-around skills and became one of the greatest players of all time. He was an NHL All-Star 23 times. Many of his scoring records held for years and years and years and years until Wayne Gretzky broke a lot of the records in the 80s. Gordie Howe retired for the first time in 1971. Then he came back 2 years later to play for the Houston Aeros of the WHA, where ironically his two sons, Mark and Marty, were playing. He was in his mid-40s at that point, but he scored over 100 points twice in 6 years, was named the most valuable player in 1974. Then, in 1978 to 1980, he returned to the National Hockey League and played one season with the Hartford Whalers. He retired at the age of 52. He is the only player to have competed in the NHL in five different decades, the 40s through the 80s. Just unbelievable. I think you'll enjoy my conversation with the great late Gordie Howe. He was so down to earth and so easy to talk to, and I so enjoyed meeting him. And then in the second half of the show, I'll replay the interview with none other than the great Wilt Chamberlain, considered one of the greatest basketball players ever. Wilt played for the Harlem Globetrotters in 58-59. Then he went to the Philadelphia Warriors, which became the San Francisco Warriors. Then in 1965 through 68, he played for the Philadelphia 76ers. And then the LA Lakers from 1968 to 1973. He was a 7-foot-1 giant and had to bend his knees to walk into the entrance of the room at the Waldorf Astoria where we actually taped the show. In fact, I have a great photo of him standing next to me near our TV cameras, and his knees are definitely bent. You know, a lot of the ceilings in the older hotels aren't as high, and I'm sure he had a lot of areas where he had to basically bend his knees just to get through the door. And the Waldorf was one of them. Anyway, Wilt is the only player to score 100 points in a single NBA game. And the fact that that record still stands after all these years is truly a testament to his incredible skills and talents. He's just such a legend. He had a successful career winning 2 NBA championships, earning 4 regular season MVP awards. He won the Rookie of the Year award. He won an MVP award in an NBA Finals. He was selected to 13 All-Star games, 10 All-NBA first and second teams. He was inducted into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame back in 78. And was chosen years later as one of the 50 greatest players in NBA history. And yes, for those of you who know your sports history, I did talk to Wilt about his admitting that he slept with over 20,000 women. Certainly a crazy, crazy admission, not only during those years in the 90s when I interviewed him, but I would think a crazy admission anytime. But you'll have to hear the interview to hear how he arrived at that calculation. All right. Well, the biggest news in sports this week, obviously Tom Brady saying goodbye to the New England Patriots, where the 42-year-old quarterback played 20 seasons, won 6 Super Bowl rings, picked up 3 MVP awards. He signed his contract with the Tampa Bay Bucks yesterday, reportedly a guaranteed $25 million per year for 2 years. Brady had restructured his contract a few times when he played for the Patriots to help them stay below the cap, and he had not earned more than $23 million a season before now, and that's $25 million per year he will earn with Tampa Bay. The Bucks, they were 7-9 last year. What an acquisition for the Bucks. And I still cannot believe that New England coach Belichick and Pat's owner Robert Kraft didn't try harder to keep the greatest quarterback of all time. I got the sense throughout the year last season that there was definitely bad blood between Brady and Belichick, that they didn't see eye to eye on a number of things. And Robert Kraft even said, you know, Brady was like a son to him, but it didn't look like to me that they did much to try to keep him in Boston. So it's surprising that they wouldn't do more to keep, you know, this guy, even for like another 1 or 2 years where he could end his career as a New England Patriot. I mean, the guy is the greatest quarterback ever. Why didn't New England try to keep him? Just to finish out his career in New England. Obviously, he wants to start, Brady, so he felt like he can go to this new team in Tampa. He wanted to stay on the East Coast because his son is in New York. His kids are all on the East Coast, and because the Chargers were interested in him. But, I also read where they, you know, he's from the West Coast, and Giselle, his wife, the model, didn't want to be on the West Coast. They all wanted to stay on the East Coast. So whatever personal reasons he had that really warranted his leaving the Patriots and staying on the East Coast, signing with Tampa Bay, obviously they came up with the big bucks, and he knows he's going to start new. They have some really great receivers that he's going to be working with. Mike Evans, Chris Godwin, But, you know, to me, the story is that it didn't really look like, you know, the Pats wanted to keep him. And I wonder why. I know, you know, they probably figured, you know, he wasn't at his prime. But Tom Brady, even at what, the age of 42, and with all the wins and with all his experience, is so much better than any other quarterback out there. So if I were a New England Patriots fan, I would really be upset. All right, we are going to take a quick break, come back, and you will first hear my interview with the great Gordie Howe. And then in the second half of the show, Wilt Chamberlain, two classic sports interviews. Sports Interview with Ann LaGoria is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and my Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses. That's PEAK Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game. PeakVision.com. My guest is Gordie Howe, Mr. Hockey. It's so good to see you.
Well, it's nice to be back in New York. It's been a little while.
You don't come to New York that much.
No, I'm not saying I'm stuck out. I live out in Michigan, and most of my travel takes me west.
You fish a lot, right?
I love to. I'm like catfish. He goes with a gun, I go with a rod, yeah.
You like the salmon stuff, mm-hmm. The salmon fishing.
It's right in the backyard where we live in Traverse City. All I have to do is run across the grass into the boat, and I'm fishing within a minute. So it's I'm not catching. As the old saying goes, I'm fishing. I'm not catching too much, but I'm doing a lot of fishing.
You know, it's amazing when you say Gordie Howe. When you say that name, any sports fan thinks of longevity. You played in 5 decades.
I played in the 40s, and then I end up the first year, like 1980. That was my last year. So
you played from 1946 to 71. Took some time off. Actually retired. Then came back and played from 73 to 80.
And probably the most enjoyable years I ever had. And not to knock Detroit, which was 25 great years I had in there, but to realize something, to play hockey with your two sons for 7 years. That's supposed to be 1 year I signed for, but there was too much fun involved. I didn't want to quit. So I went on. We played 4 in Houston, went into... played with the Whalers in Hartford, Connecticut, and the last year was enjoyable because it put me back in the NHL. That was the year they had the merger. So it put me in the NHL with Marty and Mark, which was great.
You know, in the 40s and 50s, Gordie, hockey was really coming into its own, and you were a big reason for that prosperity. And then all of a sudden you retire, and then come back and join the WHA. And that must have sent shockwaves throughout the sport. What was it like back then when you finally made that decision? Because everybody thought you had retired.
Well, I had retired because I had arthritis had set in. I had a bone removed from my wrist, my left wrist, and I was playing basically in pain. So it takes a lot of fun out of the game, and all athletes would tell you when the fun leaves, and that's when you leave the game. And pain can take away a lot of the fun. But the realization when my wife Colleen, when she did the contracts with Houston, all of a sudden, somewhere along the line, my name was thrown in. And she remembers very well because way back when the boys were juniors and I played for the parent Red Wings, I put the junior Red Wing uniform on, played with them in a charity fundraiser. And it was during that time was 15,000 standing ovation. We looked at Colleen, I said, this would be great if it was for real. So that she made it a reality.
So she was the agent in all
this? She was the agent.
Your mm-hmm. wife, has she mm-hmm. always represented you with contracts?
Always. Well, since the time we got married. At the start, management wouldn't allow too many women in the front office.
I guess not back
then. As
a
matter of fact, there's on a few occasions, they almost blocked the door on the ladies. And you take many years ago, at one time, when even into the Hall of Fame, they wouldn't allow the wives of the family in, and that turned, I think, when I was, I know when I was inducted in the Hall of Fame in 72, that was the first time they allowed family members in, so that was pretty nice.
So hockey players did not have agents back then?
Well, they had them later on. That's, I guess, when McCormick got involved.
Mark McCormick, but,
yes,
right.
But up until that point, I never heard of agents. We went in there, and it's really funny when you come out of the West, you're so trusting, and you just walk in and just simply look at them and say, well, am I supposed to be good? Pay me accordingly, and I'll sign it tomorrow.
Right.
That was my big argument.
Boy, times have changed since those days, right?
Yes. I think somebody, you walk around to get the guy I think the most of you and say, good, you're my agent. But you have to have, because I think what they do is they cut that fog between you and management, because they can argue as much as they want. I've always felt, as a lot of people do, that maybe you should sit in there and listen to see what the agent is saying, because if he's saying something that you can't produce, it's not a very good thing for the athlete.
So you never had an agent in your whole career?
Other than Colleen, no.
You had arthritis, you had said. How did you feel physically when you came back?
Scared. I shouldn't say scared. I was concerned, because could I regain anything I had, and because of 2 years off and I'm age of 40-something, I thought, oh. But then I had to realize that when I was 40 years of age in the NHL, I think I had around 100 points. And so that was the most I've had as a player in the NHL. So when we got down there, I think the boys were more concerned because of my color. Number one, I was losing my color out there, and I was
really?
I couldn't catch my wind.
How old were you when you first joined Houston?
43. So then I go into the locker room, you know, and just thinking, is this a mistake? And then Coach Bill Dineen said, we're going twice a day.
Oh, boy.
So, oh,
oxygen,
yeah, that's
please,
right.
Somewhere.
So all of a sudden, I went in there with the hopes of maybe, you know, it's either kill or cure, one of the two. So when I went into the second in the afternoon session, I felt like $1 million, and the Suns came over to me, and I remember Mark, because he's on my left wing, he said, it's coming back, isn't it? And I said, is it noticeable? And he said, yeah, I'm not running all over the ice for your pass. Your color is good. And he said, you're not only keeping up, you're ahead of a lot of us. So that made me feel pretty good.
You had 104 points in the WHA.
Right.
Unbelievable. Which they didn't count in your all-time scoring total.
That's why it's confusing me. They don't count that yet. When Wayne Gretzky, who should have won the Rookie of the Year award, didn't receive that award for the fact that he'd had professional experience in WHA.
But he only scored in the 40s.
Sense. That's okay. They could see the potential of the young man. He's always had. I met Wayne when he was about 12.
And I think you were his idol.
Yeah, he had 180 goals in about 15 games or something. It's something tremendous, whatever it was. So it's not by accident the kid is as good as he is.
He always said he wanted to look like you, he wanted to dress like you, he wanted to talk
he
like you.
He wanted to cut his hair back.
He wanted to cut his hair like you.
That'll come soon enough, right?
And at one point, Gordon, in your career, you had a really awful collision on the ice. Very severe head injury, and doctors didn't think you'd even recover, let alone get back to hockey. And I know you came back and won the scoring title the next year.
They didn't know how thick that bone was.
Tell me about that. How awful was that when you first hit your head?
To me, it didn't mean that much because, number one, I lost a day. I had no idea what went on. In mechanics of it, well, I was in the wrong position and doing what I should do, and anticipating a pass, I leaned way over, and in doing so, when Kennedy released the pass, he came around, spiked me right in the eye and the nose, and then that basically put me out, but then I ran into the boards, they say, after that. So I went to the hospital, and within about a half hour I was on the operating table, they had to release the pressure. Now, my only concern was when I woke up that maybe a day and a half later, you know, I went in there and lift the bandage up, and I could see an image, and I said, good, I'm all right. And it settled me down, and my mother, who had never flown, the Red Wings flew my mother and my sister in to see how I was, and when she walked into the room, she looked almost worse off than I was. She was very sick from being air sick, so I offered her my bed and I was going to get up. But it was at one time, had it been a small city, maybe it out back out in my hometown of Saskatoon or some small area where the medical attention wasn't exactly right there, I could have been in trouble, I think. But as it was, it woke me up. It's just I changed my hockey.
You actually came back tougher. People said you were much more of an instigator when you came back.
I said, I'm going to play religious hockey. It's better to give than receive. So that was, and I learned a lesson, which I try to relate to the kids today, on the position. When you're playing a game, it's 50-50. You stand a chance to get hurt as much as the other guy. If the odds are in your favor, be my guest. But don't go against the odds, and you'll last longer.
A Ranger was once quoted as saying you were the dirtiest player in the game.
Well, probably Lou Fanato.
No, he didn't mention the name. No. Obviously, he was afraid of you. He didn't want you to hit him against
no,
the boards.
Well, but my son Mark said the same thing. He said, what did you do that for? That was dirty. And I said, don't ask me.
Do you feel that you were the dirtiest player in the game?
No, I said aggressive. Aggressive, I think, is a better word. But if somebody did something deliberate, yes, they could expect it back. And I laughed at Stan Mikita. I did one time with him. He just skated by me, and he slipped me on a little stick on the lip, cut my lip, and went over, and I said, I'll cancel that check. So I went out there, and Stan said he thought I'd gone senile, and I'd forgotten all about it. But three games later, I had a position where nobody's looking. I just turned around and hit him on the forehead with my fist. If you promise somebody something, then
you have to deliver.
You better deliver,
especially
it.
Checks.
But
the
it
checks
was,
in the mail.
But basically, I think that's what a lot of guys said. There's a respectful deal there, but there's on the other hand, the people I played against who are people I respect, like Emil Schmidt or Watson, say Phil Watson, what I would do is, I would go into the corner because I learned that in a hurry. And Mr. Watson said to me, I played against him when he was with the Air Force in Saskatoon. Now I'm playing him when we're playing against Toronto. And he went in the corner. He said, "Look out, Gordy." Well, this is unusual. He's supposed to nail me. I had the puck. So I just relaxed and we froze the puck. And then I did the same thing to him. I learned very quickly. About two periods later, I did the same thing to him down there. It was Harry Watson, sorry, not Phil. He was a coach in New York, but Harry Watson. I went in the corner and I said, "Look out, Mr. Watson."
And he looked. You'd warn him at least.
Yeah, and he looked at me and said, "We're going to get along just fine." And I played 12 years that way against him.
What player out there in hockey reminds you of you? Somebody who maneuvers really well, who's very physical, who intimidates. Anybody?
Well, see, I've never seen myself play, but the big Eric Lindros plays my style.
Physical,
and he's big.
Maneuvers well.
Yeah, he maneuvers well, and he's so strong. He, in a little exhibition game we were playing, he said, "Let me try your stick," and he leaned on it, and I had a broken stick. He's a powerful kid.
Ultimate stylist,
they
called you.
What I appreciate as a somebody who's been around for 32 years playing, I got to learn something, and I saw what was getting him hurt, so I went to him, and I respect his family very much so. And
so what'd you tell him? What kind of advice?
Well,
did you
give him? Well, the only advice on the 50-50 basis, if it's 50-50 and you're 15 feet apart and the puck is dead center, if there's a collision going to be head, you stand an equal chance of getting hurt. If it's 60-40 in your favor, then go for it. And so because you're going to get cut up, you're going to get your legs are going to attack his legs. They're not going to hit him physically above. So he'd end up with a bad knee because he took a run at somebody. So it's.
What did he say when you told him this?
He didn't say a word, but he said it all when he accepted the MVP. He thanked me for the advice.
Did you ever consider coaching?
I did. One time I told him I was one phone call away from being. Being a coach, I never got it. So
you never got a phone call.
They thought I had so much fun on the ice. I've always had fun on the ice.
But you never pursued it. You never really aggressively pursued coaching.
No, I think my strongest point was when I was in Hartford. I did a lot of coaching on my own. I'd see an obvious glaring mistake or somebody going wrong, and even Bobby Hajek. I thought Bobby was on finally got an NHL championship this year. Before he went to Jersey, he was in Hartford, and he was the worst passing European I ever saw in my life. And I pinpointed him like almost like a camera's eye on him, and I followed him, and it was so obvious. His hands position was so terrible; nobody could shoot the puck straight or be accurate. I went down, spent 5 minutes with him, and he looked at me, and all he could say is, "I said, you understand me, Bobby?" He says, "Yeah," so this is one-way conversation. But finally. he shot it, and he looked at me surprised. It worked. And then
sometimes it's just the teeniest tidbit of advice that can really change a person.
It's little things. And at the age of 40 almost, when Sid Abel was around Detroit and had retired, I'd well into my 20th year in the league. I'd ask Sid if he's going to be at the game that night, tell me what I'm doing wrong. I'm ahead of the player, behind the play. And he'd just, you know, it's simple things. You said you're leaving your zone too early. And so I, because of the changing of the center, one was a little slower and the other was getting the puck to you, so I had to come later. So it's it does not hurt to be a little, you know, throw your ego out the window and ask a few questions.
Yeah,
I don't care what
advice.
Age you are. And
especially
helped.
From Gordie Howe. Are you kidding?
It helped me, and hopefully it helped others.
Hear that? Teacher Gordie Howe. Maybe future coach. We'll be back with Gordie Howe right after this. We're back with Gordie Howe, who played in five decades, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and I bet if we asked you to play today, you'd say no problem. Sign him up for the Rangers.
I play, but it's slow motion. It's poetry in slow motion. As we play, we still, a lot of the past players get out there and have fun and raise money for charity.
You have a funny story. Well, you used to give the refs a hard time. It's very intimidating. Winger and a very physical player, an ultimate stylist. You had a way about you that was fun. You had fun on the ice. And there's this great story about this ref, Frank
Udaveri.
And you said to him, you were upset, he made a bad call. And you said, you're the second best referee in the NHL. And he said, well, who's the first? And you said, everybody else.
Put the record straight. No, there, I'm not playing now, obviously, but in the past, when there's only six teams, you got to know the individuals personally, and they knew you. So when they knew when you're out of character, so the penalties are called. But Red Story was one of my favorites, and I know he called a penalty, and he gave somebody on our team a penalty who wasn't even on the ice. And I looked and I said, Red, are you going bonkers? I said, he wasn't even on the ice. He said, give me credit, I got the right team. So they would talk to the players, and just for lack of, you know, other words, he said, gentlemen, stop this arguing, play hockey, I need a beer before I hit the train. And that's what and all jokingly, but they would get the message. And
are the refs better today, or?
I think they got a tougher job today. The game is quicker because when they went from the one-line pass to the lines the puck precedes you on the ice, all 200 feet are open. So it's a much quicker game. So I think as good as they are, they're still under rules. I think with TV, they got to get the game over in a certain period of time. So if the infraction isn't an obvious, I'm going to hurt somebody situation, they'll let that go.
Gordie, I know at one point in your career, within the last 5 years even, before Commissioner Bettman took over, you felt as if you were being used by the National Hockey League. You felt like they only called you when they obviously wanted to use your name and wanted to show you off a little bit. And has that changed?
I think it has a little bit. It's Bettman and Burke. Burke's always been, I've always admired his ability, and Bettman I just got to know. But the yes, as a rule, most of the time, it's just a coincidence. When I got invited to one of the All-Star games, I asked if my wife could come, and they said no. And now that's being used. It's you're not getting paid. It's just, they said it's exposure, and I said people die from exposure. You know, so it's basically. And
so you didn't go?
I went because of my position in the game of hockey. It was a part of my duties.
And how long ago was this?
And that was about 12 years ago.
Before? So
yeah, well before Bettman. Yeah.
The change.
And, but it was, I would say families were used, not just Gordie Howe. A lot of them were put in a position that they felt they had to do it. And my love for the game of hockey, and if I could assist them to improve it, I'd do it. And I still do it today.
What do you dislike most about the game, the way it's changed through all the years?
I don't dislike too much. I shouldn't say that. The hooking. I think what the hooking and the cross-checking.
You never did that?
Most of it was with a fist. I hit him in the back of the, just to let him know I was there. That doesn't hurt you. A stick will break bones. So it's, but I've done a lot of things. I have to get off the ice. What did I do that for? But it was just a spur of the moment. That's the makeup of the individual. You see a lot of ball players. I was sitting with Al Kaline, watching a baseball game, and the New York pitcher, it was Reynolds, I believe it was. He was in a position, they were ahead by 5 runs, and somebody was up to bat, and he says, watch him. He'll hit him. I don't know where, but he'll hit him.
And he hit him.
Got him on the wrist. The pitcher did. It's you know what's coming. And in hockey, you know the same thing. If you've done something bad to one of the, especially when I was playing with the two sons, and somebody take a rap at the son, you know darn well I wouldn't be very far behind. And even to the point where Mark had to beg, he said, Dad, leave me alone. I can absorb his hit, but I can't absorb yours with it. So it's a cute
family affair.
It's always
what a great
family
story. Thanks so much, Gordy, for coming on.
You.
I really appreciate
it's
it. Good
pleasure.
Luck with everything.
Thank you. And during the process, when a car came out on the ice, Mom and Dad stepped out of the car, and that was my 13th year in the league, and that's the first time they'd ever seen me play. That was if you ever cried in front of 15,000 people, it happens. So anyway, and then I think the fact that I went on the ice with Marty and Mark professionally for the first time in Houston, Texas, that was unbelievable feeling for me. And then the Texans didn't know how to spell. They had on my back, they misspelled the word Gordy. It was go ride. So my sons were calling me Go Ride, and I said, what's with you guys? You look in the mirror. So I had to change it the next day.
Sports Interview with Anne LaGoria is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and my Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses. That's PEAK Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity, change your game, peakvision.com.
There's a will, there's a way. And I'm delighted to have Wilt Chamberlain here today. How are you, Wilt?
Just fine. Nice to be here.
What an extraordinary athlete you continue to be long after your basketball playing career. And this book, Wilt Chamberlain, A View from Above, says it all. I mean, you don't leave anything hidden from the reader. Why now? Why pour it all out now?
That's a good question. In 1989, in December, I was thinking about the 90s coming up, and I quickly reflected on the 80s, and Will Chamberlain was not happy with the 80s in himself. Too much time in Hawaii, laying on the beaches, working on my tan, and I just thought that was not necessary, you know? And I said, let me write down, kind of jot down some stuff and figure out what I was not doing. Maybe I could figure out what I should do better in the 90s. It evolved into this book. And being reflective, I said, if I'm going to write a book about things that I did and things that I didn't do, I definitely want to be honest about it. I'm going to be talking about myself. And I must tell people that you look in the mirror, you see yourself, you see your image, you see your outside self. If you write about yourself, you see your inside self, and you see really your soul to a degree. And so I bared my soul here.
You certainly did bare your soul. You expressed your innermost feelings about so many subjects that I want to get into all of them, but you wrote it by yourself. Most athletes never do that.
Well, I think most...
But you know, most athletes,
yeah,
right?
Well, yeah, and plus, you know, most athletes never think about doing that. They think it's going to be too tough. It is tough, but boy, it's very rewarding, you know. And then some guy always comes along and says, I'm a writer and I'd like to do your book. So that sounds like the easy way. So they take the easy way out. I'm very happy to have written this myself, and I was fortunate. My first book, 18 years ago, was written with a guy who won a Pulitzer Prize just last year. So he was a great, great writer. I was not unhappy with that, but I wanted to do this on my own.
And you dedicated it to your mother and father.
Absolutely. They were my tree. They were my landing tree. And everything I really have, you know, is a direct result from what they taught me and what they gave me.
You had a nice childhood,
a very solid childhood,
and that's very important.
Yeah, you know, the only thing that was not so nice, but I needed the foundation and the warmth that came from my family and my friends, was that I was this height at 14 years of age.
7 foot.
Yeah, and can you imagine going through America at that time, a man of color, a little boy, 14 years old, that height? You know, I was looked upon as a freak. Today, when you see someone close to my size or whatever, people think sports, basketball, Zoom, dollar signs, and they don't think of, you know, circus, freak, or what have you. So, you know, it has changed a lot, and that was really the toughest thing for me was, you know, growing up and being stared at and being looked at and being talked about in that particular way. Other than that, it was a good childhood.
Did it give you a complex? I mean, did it make you feel insecure? Oh, wow, I'm so tall.
Well, not insecure, but, you know, I kind of like wanted to hide a little bit. I didn't want to, like, bring that notice to me if I was on, like, the bus or we had the L, you know what I'm saying? I was always sit down. I was taught to stand up and give my seat to ladies or women, and I never did. I was just always just going to sit there because if I stood up, my head would be, like, almost touching the ceiling. I know everybody would look. So I was really quite conscious about that.
I love the story when you get into the elevator and there are two guys taller than you.
Yeah, three guys.
And who were they? Ralph Sampson?
Yeah, Ralph Sampson and a guy named Bowie, who both are in the NBA right now. The third guy, I'm not really, really sure about.
But that must be refreshing to see guys taller. And you spent a lot of time in the book talking about the height factor. Mm-hmm. So obviously, it's been so much a part of your life.
It really has been. In fact, I say in the book that I misunderstood. And I mean by that is that, you know, I was played the villain so much because I was bigger and stronger than most. And they cast me as the villain and everywhere I went. And villains are kind of hard to really, really know on a personal level when you see them as mean, unsensitive type people. And also when you have this great size, sensitivity once again is not given to you. They talk about all these things that you can do and whatever, but never do they say, are you gentle, really sensitive about things? And we are, you know, and we have that going for us. If you know, a big dog tends to be much more at ease with kids and gentle with them, then the little one is always yelping and yelping and yelping, you know. So I don't know where they get that because you're big, you have to have this gruffness about you.
You do mention the sensitivity issue in the book about sex and how rewarding it felt for you that the woman would find you very sensual and sensitive, that it was such a shock to some of people you could be that way.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that a second. You know, I say that, you know, you want to be treated, you know, just like everybody else in that respect. But on the other hand, viva la difference. I mean, I think by being different helped me in a lot of ways in life. You know, I think my attraction, if there was an attraction that women had for me, was the fact that I was different. Of course, when you're famous, you have a little bit more money than some people, and you're involved in something like professional sports, that's an attraction. I think a lot of ladies found me some attraction because I was different. And, you know, and I acted on that in a way.
We're back with Wilt Chamberlain, extraordinary athlete. Everybody knows you averaged 50 points for a season, 100 points in a game against the Knicks at one point. Your greatest feat, however, you only missed 7 minutes in one season. I think it was your third season in the NBA.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Seven minutes.
Yeah, and you know, understand, you know, 80-some games and, you know, only missed. I went 51 complete games without ever missing a minute. And why that makes me feel good is because, you know, as an athlete, you believe in doing things and longevity kind of proves your worth, you understand?
Consistency.
And consistency, that's the word I was really looking for. And I was paid to play basketball and people paid to come and see me. And so my coach and the owners felt like, hey, people pay to see him, leave him out there and let him see him. And I was able to deal with it in such a way that only missing 7 minutes. And I look back on it now and go, hey, Hal, you know, I can't believe it myself.
Unbelievable. Volleyball, you went to the top. Mm-hmm. You could have been, you say in the book, the best decathlete in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I you know, I don't want to say the best in the world, but I think I had the ingredients. I think I had the properties, strength, stamina, a certain amount of agility, the real competition to achieve, and the love of track and field, which was my natural and first sport. And I that was the thing I wanted to do most. It's the thing I really regret the most, really? not doing.
The discus?
The discus shot. And the shot, right. All those kind of things. I mean, that's really me. And so I thought I had those properties to make me, if not the best, right up the top.
I know you did a 4.4 and a 40-yard dash.
Yeah, that's
you were
right.
A sprinter.
Yeah, right. I can. Yeah.
Do you wish you could have another life to come back as a track
not?
And a
absolutely.
Star?
I mean, or just knock off 20 years and let me go back in this life right here and do it. Yeah.
Even boxing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I know at one point you were had a match or
yeah.
considering a match mm-hmm. against Muhammad Ali.
Right. Actually, you're right. I actually had a match. It was a proposed match. We were like that close. I mean, within seconds of signing. At the Houston Astrodome back in 1969. Customato was my trainer and manager. He felt as if, that I had the properties to do well in the boxing game. He said to me, "Will, I can teach you how to beat one person. I can teach you to beat Muhammad Ali. Yeah. And he will not know anything about what you can do, but you'll know everything about what he can do." I mean, I respect Muhammad Ali, and I know he's a great boxer, And I remember telling my father that I was maybe going to fight Muhammad Ali. My father looked at me, who was the biggest boxing fan in the world, and he says, "My advice is go work on your foul shooting." And I said, "Okay, Dad."
Keep your feet on the ground, son.
Right, absolutely right. I started to believe in what Cuss was saying, and we came very, very close to doing so. And I must say, there was a fear. And one of the fears, though, was sort of like quieted because I believe that Muhammad was a gentle, good man. And if he was really much too much for me, he might have just, I thought, knocked me out gently. But boxing is a strange sport. I mean, with some of the things they had going on for me, there might have been a chance that maybe I could have done something very, very bad to him.
I know Jim Brown has wanted to race you has always said, "Come on, let's go. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, Jim is the most competitive man that I've ever met. And not only is he is competitive, he's very apt at doing most things better than most people. Jim, though, did find it very hard to believe that someone of my size could outrun him at what he was supposed to be very, very good at doing. And he would forever like challenge me in races of 40-yard dashes. He'll come and pull me out of a party when I'm trying to talk to a young lady. I say, "Hey, Jim, I have no sneaks on." He'd be in the sneaks and ready. He said, "Oh, take your shoes off and we'll go out there and do it." I'd go out there and run Jim, beat him, and people would be watching me come back. It would be dark. And he says, "Well, it was close. It was like a tie." I said, "Come on, Jim.
Could never admit it, huh?"
No. He had a hard time. Even today, he has a hard time admitting it.
He doesn't like to lose, that's
for
sure.
Yeah, he does.
None of you guys like to lose.
No, none of us do. None of us do. But, I'm willing to admit that, maybe some people could beat me. Even I used to challenge the little guards. My thing I liked was to challenge guys who were smaller, guys who were supposed to be quicker.
Sure.
Because I think subconsciously, I was trying to prove to people it wasn't just my height that was getting me across in these various sports. It was some other intrinsic things that I had, some other properties that I had that made me a good athlete.
So there's that height factor coming in
Once again.
Now it enters the picture.
Yeah, absolutely.
Way back when.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Jim Brown wrote a book, as a lot of athletes have, an autobiography, and he was very complimentary of you in some ways, but critical of you in others. Mm-hmm. He was quoted as saying in the book, "Despite your monstrous talent, Wilt has never been secure with Wilt."
Well, he has a right, and maybe that's how he feels about it. And I can't deny him having that right to feel that way. I feel very secure with Wilt. He sees me. I joke around, kid around a lot, which maybe he may take the wrong way. But I think Wilt Chamberlain, as age has come upon him, is even much more secure. Even though I can do less, I feel much more secure about it.
You don't seem like you're doing less to me. I think you're doing more.
You might be right about that.
The movie with Arnold.
Right.
What was
right.
it? Conan the Destroyer.
Yeah, I messed up there.
Why?
Because, you see, I had a chance to kill Arnold in that picture. And if I had knocked him off like I was supposed to, maybe I would have been the Terminator and making $15 million, a picture and what have you.
So Your biceps were bigger than his.
Yeah, they were bigger, and they kind of kept us away from each other because of those kind of things. Those guys are proud, we're proud of what we're all about. They're proud of their bodies, They don't want to look like, "Hey, all of a sudden I'm puny." No. And there's no way he's puny. He's the hardest working guy I've ever seen.
I have a feeling that's your theme. As long as you can work hard, you're in.
Yeah. I believe that, it's a gift that we are given the chance to do so. And if you, really go out there and fulfill that, life is going to be good for you.
You have a soft spot in your heart for mm-hmm. women because mm. of the fact that you had sisters when mm. you were growing up, mm-hmm. and so you're very involved with women's sports, women's yeah. athletics.
Well, you know, I had two sisters in particular, one Barbara, one Selena. Selena played basketball. Barbara was able to run very, very fast. I used to take her by the hand and pull her to get her started running, and then she was like almost running beside me all the time. And believe me, I was fast. But there was no real outlet ever for them to go anywhere. Wilma Rudolph, sure. though, made it you know, sort of a dignified thing also for women to go out there and do their thing.
Even when I was in high school, women yeah. athletes weren't respected.
No, of course not. And you know, I went to Russia a lot with the Globies, and I had a chance to watch their program. And they were very smart. They used their women in a way to help to bring national acclaim to their country and to their whole program. And for a while, the only women you saw in sports and dominating were the Russian women. And so when I got back to America, I became very, very pro trying to get involved and get women involved. You know, so I started with my volleyball team. I had women volleyball team called the Little Dippers.
Sure.
And then I got at a women's track and field team called Wilt's Wonder Women. And I mean, and I've just been involved. I mean, I also like to watch, not because they're beautiful and graceful. It's easy to watch. I prefer watching a woman's tennis match,
really?
To a men's tennis.
Long rallies.
You can see him really stroke the ball. You can see him do the things that are necessary to become a good tennis player.
And they have the power that some of them do today with Monica Seles.
I've rallied with Jennifer Capriati, so you know, they're tremendous. What I want them to do though, is I want them to develop a game that would enhance what they have going for them. Something to do with, you know, grace, you know, and flexibility and stamina and, you know, the threshold of pain that they can deal with. All the sports are mainly, you know,
geared
sort of like,
toward men.
Yeah, absolutely, for their power, their speed, and their strength.
Any ideas?
No,
maybe
no,
that's your next project.
Yeah, maybe it's my next
create
project.
Create a sport just for women.
For women, but all these great PhDs and physical education stuff out there, come up with something.
Bill Russell, have you talked to him at all?
Haven't talked to Bill Russell in maybe 22 years.
And because he didn't apologize during that one instance?
Well, not because he didn't apologize, because it just kind of, our lives went different ways. When he left basketball, he was never around the arenas that I was, even though he stayed in basketball. He coached and he announced. But believe me, I just never saw him. We were close.
He criticized you after one game, saying that you...
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't feel like going out there, you're retired, you didn't give it your 100%.
He didn't even say what I didn't do. What he said is if it would take nothing less than a broken back for me to sit on the bench. He didn't realize that I'd asked to come back into the game and those kind of things. And you know, but it was why he said it. Someone had provoked him, and if Wilt Chamberlain had been playing, you know, would you guys think he'd have won? And here's a guy who had already won 10 world championships, you know, and against Wilt Chamberlain at him, so he didn't want to hear that BS. I understand that. I think that he was pitted against me unfairly for both of us. You're saying we were different type of basketball players, even though we played the same sport in the same position. I think that maybe some people in the world want to see us butt heads and one of us to fall. I picked him as the number one center of all time as far as I'm concerned, because he was a complete basketball player.
Over you?
Well, you know, yeah, I'm going to pick him over me right
really?
Now. Yeah, because he also helped his team to win a lot more than maybe I could have helped my team to win.
Well, that's what Bob Cousy said when quoted as talking about the differences between you and Bill Russell. He said, you might have outscored, out-assisted, out-rebounded, but Russell made the other guys better.
Yeah, right.
He wasn't as individualistic as...
Yeah. Well, and sometimes the mere power of you makes you more individualistic. I have said this before. Wilt Chamberlain and the Boston Celtics might not have been the same, because I would have taken away from Bob Cousy, from Tom Heinsohn, because I was a scorer too. And then all of a sudden, now they had to pass the ball to me, and that would take something away from them. So, you know, sometimes less is better. You know, so that's how I view it. But I'm talking about the fact that the man could score. He averaged 17 points a game, which is only about 7 points less than Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. You know, he was the supreme rebounder. He got the ball for his team, which made it happen. He's high in assists, and we all know how he played defense. You can't ask for any more from that position. So he's my choice.
You're gonna take a back seat to Bill.
Well, I mean, I'm gonna take a back seat right now. I mean, for you right now, I'm gonna take a back seat. You know. I may feel a little different maybe tomorrow.
Kind of as whimsical as your choice in women,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well, no, not really. I mean, what I'm really trying to say here is that, you know, picking who is the best is almost like picking a great dessert. It might you might feel like apple pie tonight or lemon meringue custard tomorrow. You know what I'm saying? It depends on how you feel that particular night. Both from a great dessert, so maybe you have this great desire for, you know, ice cream.
Your tastes change.
Your tastes do change about good things.
Pat Riley, You say perhaps he was fired?
Yeah,
when he left the Lakers?
I think there was a coaxing of Pat Riley maybe to retire or step down gracefully. I know there was an estranged feeling there, among a lot of people who were involved in the organization.
Wow. You think the Knicks are going to be like the Lakers were under Pat Riley at any time?
I think they have a chance. I think that Pat Riley was a good coach. I think that Pat Riley has become a different type of individual, and he demands a different thing from his team. Maybe what he's going to demand from the Knicks will make them a better team.
What's left for Wilt Chamberlain to do? You got another book. You got two books on the way, one nonfiction, one fiction, a screenplay. Mm-hmm. You don't stop.
Mm-mm. Well, I don't really want to. I don't really want to. I'm enjoying what I'm doing. I'm really happy that I'm given the opportunity to do some of these things. I'm happy for all this attention in this particular book, because any author would love to have going for him what I've had going for me the last few days.
You're an author now.
I'm an author now. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Will. Appreciate you.
My thanks to Kyle Lynch in the studio. Hope you enjoyed these classic replays of two sports interview cable shows. First one with Gordie Howell, the second with Wilt Chamberlain. Be safe, everybody. Be well. Be kind to each other. Isolate yourself, but get on the phone. Get online with your neighbors, with your friends, with your families. Let's all be in this together. You know, together we'll be better from all this. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Talk to you next Saturday morning from 9 to 10 right here on Sports Interview with Ann LaGorrie.